Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
All right, so this talk is on Flannery, on art and truth, and how she sees them as related, and also how she doesn't see them as related. So Flannery believed that art can reveal truth in a way that is very different from philosophy or theology. As a moral philosopher myself, who works on things like virtue and happiness and meaning and purpose in life, over the years, I've become really aware of the limits of argument in this space, and I have found myself drawing more deeply from literary sources as an aid in thinking about what is true in these domains. And I have this podcast. And the guiding animus of my podcast is my belief in what philosophers call aesthetic cognitivism. But that just means like there's some theoretical commitment to the idea that art reveals truth somehow. So in thinking through aesthetic cognitivism over like maybe the last 4 or 5 years, I've been drawing heavily on both on three women, Flannery, Iris Murdoch, and Simone Weil. And Flannery and Murdoch, in particular, I think have a very similar view. So both women argue that great literary art communicates a truthful vision of reality, that its principal good is its truthfulness, but and this is the important thing, as this truth is internal to the work of art itself, it cannot be understood apart from it. To put the point in a slogan, we might say that the poem or the novel cannot be reduced to paraphrase. So in order to make sense of these claims, I think we need first and foremost to be clear about what the relationship between truth reality is. In order to make sense of these claims, we need first and foremost to be clear about the relationship between truth and reality and what vision in this context is and why this idea of vision is important. And then in particular, what a literary work of art is. So Flannery and Murdoch are an interesting pair. They were very different women. Flannery is a devout Catholic. Murdoch is an atheist. And they come from very different backgrounds, right? Flannery from rural Georgia, and Murdoch, the sophisticated and rarefied atmospheres of Oxford and London. And they wrote very different kinds of fiction, and Flannery was better at it. Yet, both women give a remarkably similar account of aesthetic cognitivism, and it's an account that I find appealing and attractive and have been struggling to defend over the years. But before I sketch the positive view that I think they both hold, I want to be clear about what I think we should reject, which is basically most of what I find in the contemporary literature on aesthetic cognitivism. So I don't believe that we will make progress by assuming a tidy or well-understood division between epistemic claims on the one hand and aesthetic claims on the other. And I want to reject that way of proceeding, which is very common, because it simply assumes too much about art. That it is not, for example, fundamentally the work of reason and judgment alongside imagination and a habit of knowledge. Second, I don't think we should be satisfied with an aesthetic cognitivism that attempts to strip art down to its supposed cognitive contributions, which typically amount to nothing more than banal platitudes. For example, anyone who writes that the value of reading Madame Bovary can be captured by the fact that it, quote, provides a new perspective on adultery, is refusing to do Flaubert's tremendous novel justice as a work of art. Even if it were true that this is the quote-unquote main lesson of the novel, I don't think that it is, the extraction of such a lesson is not a good reason to read Flaubert's novel, because it totally misunderstands the nature of the good that it is trying to characterize. Third, I want to reject the view that literary art is a unique kind of thought experiment, which is a very prominent view. So there's a philosopher, Christian Baumberger, in an influential and well-regarded paper who writes the following. This is about literary art. By functioning as a thought experiment, a fictional work can provide a new perspective on a topic. And by providing a new perspective, a work can raise pertinent questions about the topic, deliver new categories for dealing with them, and teach us what it is like to be in a situation relevant to the topic. This is a really popular view, and I'm constantly amazed by how many people go in for this view, because it leaves utterly mysterious why anyone besides a philosopher or some other soul seeking, quote, new categories or pertinent questions would give over large portions of their lives to reading fiction. It seems to miss the good internal to the practice of reading fiction in the first place and replaces it with the good of theory. In a similar vein, another philosopher, Catherine Elgin, argues that fictions function as thought experiments that afford insight into human experience. For example, she argues that Oedipus Rex should be read, already strange to say read, as a thought experiment that vindicates certain Aristotelian claims about the fragility of human goodness and therefore advances our understanding of both Aristotle and the human predicament. To speak about the function of something, of course, is to pick out its aim or characteristic activity, but I just don't think that the aim fiction, I just don't think that the aim of fiction is to vindicate philosophical theory. What we lose on that view is any account of fiction as a work of art. While the scientist, the philosopher, and the artist may all be seeking truth, and I think that they do so in accordance with the demands of their disciplinary knowledge in the former case and their craft in the latter. The artist is not after something so simple as an insight into human nature or an invitation to ask a question. Such a view dramatically divorces content and form, thereby denaturing and destroying art. The function of art in all cases is to create a work, a novel, a painting, a song, a shoe, a house. Now, if the basis of art is truth, which I believe that it is, and Flannery O'Connor famously states that it is, then we have to understand that it cannot usurp or overshadow the art itself. Otherwise, the poem could be reduced to paraphrase. Now, I think, you know, these philosophers are all correct when they think that any viable aesthetic cognitivism has to find a respect in which artworks have, as one might put it, cognitive content, something internal to their status as artworks that is of cognitive significance for us. But I think these philosophers go dramatically wrong in canvassing the possibilities in terms of different forms of knowledge or understanding that do not appear in any meaningful or relevant sense to be internal to the process of art qua art. That is, they seem to have no understanding of how the cognitive content of the art is related to the artistic form. But, as Flannery O'Connor argues, this is really the essential thing. So she has this essay on the teaching of literature, where she writes the following. In the act of writing, one sees the way a thing is made and controls the action and is inseparable from the whole meaning of it. The form of a story gives it meaning, which any other form would change, And unless the student is able, to some degree, to apprehend this form, he will never apprehend anything else about the work, except what is extrinsic to it as literature, right? If you don't understand the internal form of the work, you might still understand something, some truth that is external to that form, but you will have missed the essential thing about it as a work of art. O'Connor notes that no one can just pick up a work of great literary art and immediately appreciate its truthfulness as art. Rather, like, that ability takes both discipline and a developed understanding of literary form. If this insight is correct, then we have no reason to praise a novel solely on the grounds that it contains philosophical knowledge, since our account of such knowledge is extrinsic to the form of the novel as a work of art. So then the question becomes, how does the novel contain truth in the mode of art or as a novel? And we could ask the same question when it comes to an epic poem, a painting, or a film. This is the question we should be asking. Otherwise, we risk collapsing the distinction between art and theory. And that would be bad. Like, we don't want to collapse that distinction because the artist isn't a theorist. The artist is a maker of works. Iris Murdoch claims that art is cognition in another mode. But if we miss the unique mode of this cognition, we will most certainly miss its character as art. So Flannery O'Connor famously claims that the basis of art is truth, both in matter and in mode, and that the person who aims after art and his work aims after truth in an imaginative sense. O'Connor thinks that the artist essentially aims at creating art. A novelist aims to write a great novel, and in so doing is aimed at truth in a special mode. It must be special and imaginative because the novelist's trade is quite literally to make things up. I think we have no chance of understanding what she is saying here unless we know that she thinks of art as a virtue of the practical intellect, as this is conceptualized in the Aristotelian Thomist tradition. So I just want to turn to that for a second. So a virtue is an excellent quality that enables a thing to perform its function well, and this is a really general claim. So you can say that the virtue of a knife is its sharpness, right? Because its sharpness is what allows the knife to cut well, and the function of a knife is to cut. But when we think of the virtues, right, courage, justice, and the like, we're thinking of stable dispositions of thought, action, or feeling that enable a person to live well on the whole by disposing one's capacities to operate in a coordinated way for the sake of a unifying end, namely living well as a human being. Now, in this tradition, going back even to Plato, art is a kind of virtue. And for Aristotle in particular, art is an intellectual virtue ordered not to doing, what he calls praxis or action, but to making or producing, what he calls techne, or in the Latin is facere. So this is a disposition of practical reason and judgment ordered towards the production, the making of some specific work, and so requires what St. Thomas calls recto ratio factibilium, right reason with regard to making. And making is a different sort of thing. Now, someone who possesses an art has practical knowledge. She doesn't just have knowledge about facts of the world or knowledge of general principles or even a solid grasp of theory. Rather, what she knows is how to realize the artistic form in her mind in some particular matter, and that claim generalizes. So a great writer doesn't just have a great idea or a great concept. A great writer can actually produce great works of fiction, which means that she has good judgment in relation to the work she seeks to produce. And of course, a good judgment is a true judgment. But truth here, again, is in relation to the work made. And this is a tradition that has a notion of practical truth as opposed to truth simpliciter. So then, working on this understanding, a novel doesn't simply contain truths that can be articulated outside of the artwork. If that were the case, the art is somewhat superfluous as a mechanism for truth. A summary of the truths one might find in Madame Bovary would be no substitute for reading the novel. And if one's theory of aesthetic cognitivism cannot account for this, I think it is just a failure. Artistic truths are only communicated through the art according to its own proper mode. And so an understanding of the form of the art, of the novel, of the short story is necessary in our evaluation of the truth of the novel, or the short story, or the song, or the poem, etc. Now, O'Connor says that such truth is imaginative, but she might first have clarified with Jacques Maritain that not all truth is speculative in character. Maritain notes that Aristotelians have long drawn a distinction between the truth of the speculative intellect, which consists in knowing, in conformity with what is, and the truth of the practical intellect, which consists in directing, in conformity with what ought to be according to the rule and measure of the thing to be affected. The good judgment of the artist enables her to realize her artistic vision in the work. It is the sort of judgment whose truth directs the artist in the making, right? Similar to how prudence directs a person in doing or acting or living well. So judgments that guide the production of art are not meant to track an independent reality that's already there, but to bring a work of art into being. Truthfulness in art isn't exactly the same, then, as truthfulness in theorizing. It's difficult for us to see this now because we have lost, right, this ancient medieval distinction between theoretical and practical truth. Now, I think one consequence of this distinction is that we can and must separate the work from the person who made it to a certain extent, so that when we evaluate a literary artist, we do not evaluate her personal character or her intentions or motives. Rather, we look at the work and judge the artist, qua artist, solely in relation to the work. And we do this, and we can do this, because we recognize that the possession of the intellectual habit of art does not make an artist good in the unqualified sense of virtue. It only makes her good in relation to her work. Art is not prudence any more than it is theoretical wisdom. It is just art, no more and no less. I wish more people understood this, because I think it's just very obvious that many great artists were in a variety of ways bad people. They weren't great. And on the Catholic side, you know, somebody like Graham Greene might come to mind, but the examples are really endless. I believe that Graham Greene was one of the best novelists of the 20th century. Astonishing. And it's some of the best Catholic art that we have. He was also not a great guy. Furthermore, I think we can all recognize the difference between literary art and great literary art, even when we do not ourselves possess a theoretical explanation of this difference. Literary art may be technically competent and yet not be great art. And anyone who has read a trashy novel knows this. O'Connor, Murdoch, and Simone Weil all seem to agree that great art is actually pretty rare. And what marks the difference is the artistic vision. While it is essential for the writer to learn the technique of the craft and all the skills that come along with that technique, literary art cannot be reduced to mere technique. The writer must also develop certain habits of contemplation, understood as a kind of loving attention paid to reality, that are necessary to develop a vision of reality that informs the art. Such a vision cannot be communicated in a writing class. It is the product of study and the cultivation of the mind, or as Flannery O'Connor puts it, one's whole intellectual life. So this is something that she argues in an essay called The Nature and Aim of Fiction. A mind cleared of false emotion and false sentiment and egocentricity is going to have at least those roadblocks removed from its path. If you don't think cheaply, then there at least won't be the quality of cheapness in your writing, even though you may not be able to write well. Any discipline can help you in writing. Logic, mathematics, theology, and of course, and particularly drawing. Anything that helps you to see. Anything that helps you to look. The writer should never be ashamed of staring. There is nothing that does not require his attention. So one's kind of contemplative vision of reality, when you think of the more sapiential dimension behind art, also governs the judgment one makes as an artist. But that vision is necessarily broader than art and developed outside of its narrow confines. O'Connor argues that the dramatic judgments of the fiction writer, the artist, are informed by her broader vision of reality, most especially her vision of the human person and its relation to what she will call creation. This commitment puts O'Connor, again, in the same camp as Iris Murdoch and Simone Weil, who also seek to link the development of vision to habits of contemplation. And O'Connor says that the writer has no chance without them, these habits of contemplation, since the writer's business is to contemplate experience. So in fiction, O'Connor argues, everything has its testing point in the eye, an organ which eventually involves the whole personality and as much of the world as can be got into it. This is how to understand her claim that it is wrong to assume that the writer chooses what he will see and what he will not. What one sees is given by the circumstances and by the nature of one's particular kind of perception. So the content of what she writes reflects her vision of the way things are, which means that the cultivation of the artist includes the cultivation of a vision that is broad, deep, and truthful to reality, at least the cultivation of the vision of a great artist, as opposed to a mediocre one. There is no other way for the novelist to deliver what There is no other way for the novelist to deliver what O'Connor says she ought. And this is a quote. Within the form of the book or the story, a total experience of human nature at any time. So the great artist must have vision and the sense that she's able to communicate it through her art. Now, this truthful vision, she's clear, is in some important sense external to her art, but must inform it. Perhaps in a way analogous to how grace illumines the intellect and the virtue of faith. Art is then opposed to fantasy and unreality. Here again, we see her characteristic appeal to realism. And again, we see this same appeal in the writings of Simone Weil and Iris Murdoch. So there's a wonderful essay by Simone Weil called Literature and Morals. It's very short. I think it's 5 pages. And she says this about the writers of great genius. She says that they go beyond fiction and they take us with them through fiction. Under the form of fiction, they give us something in writing that is equivalent to the depth of reality, the depth that life itself presents us with every day, even though we do not know how to grasp it because we are busy making ourselves feel good by lies. So the great fiction writer is forcing us to pay attention to what we miss in our everyday busyness and distraction. This is why reading is a contemplative activity that can bear moral fruits. So O'Connor and Vey both recognize that the great artists must, in some sense, go beyond fiction to sharpen their vision of reality, but that this vision is communicated under the form of her art. It follows that how the writer makes art is constrained in various ways by the audience, right, who is to receive the art. O'Connor argues in particular that the artist's vision, and this is a direct quote, has to be transmitted, and the limitations and blind spots of his audience will very definitely affect the way he is able to show what he sees. So if the artist wants to impact her audience, to have the proper affective and cognitive experience, she has to meet them where they are. She says, no one could write the Divine Comedy today because we do not live in Christendom. A Christian vision of reality and art will need to show up to a secular or post-Christian audience in a very different way. It follows that when we judge art, as the critic does, right, we're also judging truth in art within the limits of the form of the art, but also in accordance with our perception of reality, which necessarily goes beyond it. And so I think it follows that a critic too, at least a good critic, must have vision if he has any chance of helping others to see the art in the relevant way. And if we think about the consistent failure of her critics to understand what she was trying to communicate through her art, right, we start to see the necessity of the vision that she's talking about. In a famous interview with Brian McGee that is about the relationship between literature and philosophy, Iris Murdoch claims that philosophy and literature are both truth-seeking and truth-revealing activities, and that art is cognition in another mode. She asks us to notice how much truth a Shakespeare play contains or a great novel. When we find literature sentimental, pretentious, self-indulgent, or trivial, Murdoch insists that we are imputing some kind of falsehood to it, some distortion of reality. Very often, this is the result of the failure of the artist to be adequate to reality as it exists independent of her limited perspective on it as an individual. But she makes it clear that what makes a work of art and a work of fiction, in particular great art, is that it is imaginative rather than fantastical. In bad art, Murdoch warns us, fantasy takes charge. She argues that fantasy is the strong, cunning enemy of the discerning, intelligent, more truly inventive power of the imagination. And in condemning art for being fantastic, one is condemning it for being untrue. Fantasy cuts against the truth of art because it involves the tissue of self-aggrandizing and consoling wishes and dreams, which prevents one from seeing what is there outside of oneself. Imagination, by contrast, reveals the truth, at least within the sphere of literature. Whereas fantasy is self-indulgent and self-enclosing, imagination is the ability to see the other thing, what one might call, to use old-fashioned words, nature, reality, the world. Murdoch connects imagination with freedom and an ability to perceive and express the truth. And it is clear that O'Connor agrees with this. She once wrote that she was always irritated by people who imply that writing fiction is an escape from reality. Rather, it is a plunge into reality, and it is very shocking to the system. Both women agree with Keats that what the imagination seizes as beauty must be truth. Imagination cannot be separated from reason. They work together in art. If art is no more than making things up for aesthetic pleasures, I very much doubt O'Connor, the Thomist realist, would be drawn to it. Rather, art is a kind of mimesis, a way of trying to get at the truth of nature, the world, and reality by imitation. But it requires keen moral and artistic discernment and the use of imagination, which is grounded in sense experience. O'Connor believes, of course, in a way that Murdoch doesn't, that there is an incarnational aspect of good art, where the spiritual and the intellectual is materially realized in the particular story. And that means that the truth of fiction is not given in abstract principles or arguments, and in fact cannot be given in that form, but rather in the experiential context of the material of the particular characters in a particular story. According to Catholic theology, which animates, of course, her fiction and her criticism, in the incarnation, the divine becomes enmattered in the particular human body of a particular man in a particular time and place. Likewise, in fiction, divine truths become enmattered in the specific circumstances and materials of a story. And the perceptual realm, where vision operates, is the space of concrete particulars. This is why a moral vision can never be fully captured in philosophy or theology. It requires art, which deals with particular matter, and most especially the art of fiction, where ideas become incarnate in the lives of characters. O'Connor is convinced that literature is indispensable for the church for precisely this reason. She writes, "We in the church have overemphasized the abstract and consequently impoverished our imagination and our capacity for prophetic insight. The novelist, unlike the theologian or the philosopher, is able to penetrate and reveal the mysteries of our faith in its own unique way through a specifically artistic vision." And as I said earlier today, you know, the whole key to O'Connor's fiction, I believe, is that she is engaging consistently with a deep mystery, right? The suffering of the cross, ultimately, of all human suffering, and the fact that it's ultimately redemptive. And the main task of the fiction writer, by her lights, is not to teach the reader this valuable lesson, or to bring about aesthetic bliss, or to impart the correct theory, such as Thomism, it's not Thomism by another means, but to confront the mystery as it is incarnated in human life. That's a quote. Through an imaginative vision that pays careful attention to our sensed experience of the world. This is the fiction writer's special mode of getting at the truth. So that's what I want to say about art and truth. And now I want to kind of give a reading of one of her stories. It's a neglected story. How many people have read Parker's Back? Okay, like three of you. Yeah, I think that's pretty common when I ask people. You know, it was a story that she wrote as she was dying, and it's. It's one of, I think only two, but somebody correct me if I'm wrong, where she's dealing really explicitly with art. The other one's The Enduring Chill. Is there another one where she's dealing like very explicitly with art? I don't think so. It's also one of her funniest stories, one of her weirdest stories. And one of her darkest stories. So it really hits, you know, all the Flannery notes. And it's about this totally improbable married couple. So there's Parker, O.E. Parker, and his wife, Sarah Ruth. And really there never was a more mysterious pairing than these two hillbillies. So Sarah is plain. She's constantly described as plain, and she hates color. Her eyes are always described as gray and sharp, and they're often compared to like ice picks or other sort of blunt instruments, sharp instruments. She is fiercely and dogmatically religious. So she is described as forever sniffing up sin. She did not smoke or dip, drink whiskey, use bad language, or paint her face. And God knows some paint would have improved it. Parker, on the other hand, is covered in color. More specifically, in garish tattoos that he has collected over the years. And it's very interesting how he comes to sort of almost be like a circus freak, you know, covered in tattoos. And this goes back to an experience that he has as a young man. So this is, if you have the complete story, this is page 512. Parker was 14 when he saw a man in a fair, tattooed from head to foot. Except for his loins, which were girded with a panther hide, the man's skin was patterned, and what seemed from Parker's distance, he was near the back of the tent, standing on a bench, to be a single intricate design of brilliant color. The man, who was small and sturdy, moved about on the platform, flexing his muscles so that the arabesque of men and beasts and flowers on his skin appeared to have a subtle motion of its own. Parker was filled with emotion, lifted up as some people are when the flag passes. He was a boy whose mouth habitually hung open. He was heavy and earnest, as ordinary as a loaf of bread. When the show was over, he had remained standing on the bench, staring where the tattooed man had been until the tent was almost empty. Parker had never before felt the least motion of wonder in himself. Until he saw that man at the fair, it did not enter his head that there was anything out of the ordinary about the fact that he existed. Even then, it did not enter his head, but a peculiar unease settled in him. It was as if a blind boy had been turned so gently in a different direction that he did not know his destination had been completely changed. So this is like the first turning in Parker's life. And it is this experience of beauty. And what I find so interesting is that it's not like he was at an art museum and he looked at a Picasso. He's looking at a circus freak, right? The tattooed man. And, you know, it also turns out that Parker is this incredibly passionate, impulsive guy, right? So he's going with these impulses constantly. And once he has this experience of wonder and beauty, it is like driving him in all sorts of ways. And in particular, it is driving him to be like that man and be covered in tattoos. Now, what's interesting, if you look at the tattoos he accumulates, is it's basically like the hierarchy of being or the order of creation, right? So you have, he starts off by getting like anchors and things like this, and then he moves on. So it says, this is page 514, he had stopped having lifeless tattoos like anchors and crossed rifles. He then went on to get a tiger and a panther on each shoulder, a cobra coiled about a torch on his chest, hawks on his thighs, Elizabeth II and Philip over where his stomach and liver were, respectively. He did not care much what the subject was, so long as it was colorful. On his abdomen, he had a few obscenities, but only because that seemed the proper place for them. Parker would be satisfied with each tattoo for about a month. Then something about it that had attracted him would wear off. Whenever a decent-sized mirror was available, he would get in front of it and study his overall look. The effect was not one of an intricate arabesque of colors, but of something haphazard and botched. A huge dissatisfaction would come over him, and he would go off and find another tattooist and have another space filled up. The front of Parker was completely covered, but there were no tattoos on his back. So he's got this empty, he's got this haphazard collection of things that don't, there's like no unity there. It's a heap. But he has this, perfectly clean back. Now, Sarah Ruth hates his tattoos, right? And she says, this is her in response to him getting another tattoo. "All that there," she said, pointing to his arm, "is no better than what a full Indian would do. It's a heap of vanity." She seemed to have found the word she wanted. "Vanity of vanities," she said. She's constantly quoting the Old Testament to him. Anyway, they get married. The marriage is not going very well. An interesting little tidbit we get is that Sarah Ruth refuses to marry in a church because churches are idolatrous. Parker is miserable in this marriage, but he becomes obsessed with the idea of getting a religious tattoo because he thinks that there's no way that Sarah Ruth cannot love a religious tattoo. And he wants to, quote, bring her to heel. So he keeps thinking about what kind of tattoo is going to make his wife, who hates color, like appreciate him. And he's also he's a farmhand, and so he's working on this farm. And there's a scene in the story, it's like a very Flannery scene. On the literal level, he's riding a tractor, clearing a field. There's a giant tree in the middle of the field that he has to navigate around. But he's so up in his fantasies about his tattoos that he runs smack into the tree. He crashes, right? So this is how she describes it. "The sun, the size of a golf ball, began to switch regularly from in front to behind him, but he appeared to see it in both places, as if he had eyes in the back of his head. All at once, he saw the tree reaching out to grasp him. A ferocious thud propelled him into the air, and he heard himself yelling in an unbelievably loud voice, 'God above!' He landed on his back while the tractor crashed upside down into the tree, and it burst into flames. The first thing Parker saw were his shoes, quickly being eaten by the fire. One was caught under the tractor, the other was some distance away, burning by himself. He was not in them. He could feel the hot breath of the burning tree on his face." Right? So this is an image, I think, a biblical image of the burning bush, right? And what does the burning bush say to Moses? Anyone remember?
"Take off your sandals."
So Moses also has to take off his sandals because he's on holy ground. But God reveals something about himself in the fire. Yeah.
I mean, this is the principle for all metaphysics. I am who I
am. Yes, exactly. So this is not a throwaway image. I think it's the key. Because remember, what sets Parker in motion is this, he's suddenly aware that it's a bit extraordinary that he exists. And somehow, seeing the tattooed man in the fair sparks this realization, this sense of wonder. And this is really the dramatic action of the rest of the story, right? Like, Parker is totally different after this, after running his tractor smack into the tree. So now he just jumps in his truck and he's on his way and he's like, "Oh, I have to get this tattoo. It cannot wait. It must happen now." And so he runs into the tattoo artist and he says, "Let me see the book you got with all the pictures of God in it, the religious one." And the artist is like, "I don't put tattoos on drunks. You know me, I'm O.E. Parker. You done work for me before and I always paid," right? And so he's like, "What are you interested in? Saints, angels, Christ, or what?" "God," Parker said. "Father, Son, or Spirit?" "Just God," Parker said impatiently. "Christ, I don't care, just so it's God." So he's flipping madly through this book, and he's seeing all these images, the Good Shepherd, for, you know, the smiling Jesus, Jesus the physician's friend, yada, yada, yada. So he's going back and back. And then it says, on one of the pages, a pair of eyes glanced at him swiftly. Parker sped on, but then stopped. His heart, too, appeared to cut off. There was an absolute silence. It said as plainly as if silence were a language itself, go back. Parker returned to the picture, the haloed head of a flat-stern Byzantine Christ with all-demanding eyes. He sat there trembling. His heart began slowly to beat again, as if he were being brought to life by a subtle power. Right? He's like, this is the one. And the tattoo artist is like, well, this is going to take several days because it's a huge Byzantine, right, a bit of iconography. So he gets like half of it done, but the eyes are missing. And the eyes are like the whole thing, right, for Parker. So he spends the night at the Haven of Light Christian Mission because he can't go home. He can't go home. The next morning he's there before the tattoo artist. He has to have this. Then he has a dream with the burning tree again, reaching out to grasp him, and of his shoes being on fire. And he's still barefoot. Constantly in this story, we are reminded that he is still barefoot. And there's a lot of contrasting imagery between Sarah Ruth's eyes and the all-demanding eyes of Christ. And so he's talking to the tattoo artist, and he's just like, why are you doing this? And he's like, I'm doing it for my wife. She can't say she don't like the looks of God, right? So he's got to please her. So he gets the tattoo. He goes to a bar before he goes home. And there's an altercation between him and the other guys in the bar because they are making fun of him for having a giant Jesus on his back. And so this is what we read here. He's now outside of the bar, very upset. Parker sat for a long time on the ground in the alley behind the pool hall, examining his soul. He saw it as a spider web of facts and lies that was not at all important to him, but which appeared to be necessary in spite of his opinion. The eyes that were now forever on his back were eyes to be obeyed. He was as certain of it as he had ever been of anything. Throughout his life, grumbling and sometimes cursing, often afraid, once in rapture, Parker had obeyed whatever instinct of this kind had come to him. In rapture, when his spirit had lifted at the sight of the tattooed man at the fair, afraid when he had joined the Navy, grumbling when he had married Sarah Ruth, right? And in neither of these cases did he understand what was happening. He just went with it. And he is also here directly compared to Jonah, who had been cast into the sea. And so now he's racing home to Sarah Ruth. She's locked him out because he's been gone for 2 days. And this is what happens when he finally goes home to his wife and shows him the tattoo that he is convinced is going to make her really love him. Parker turned his head as if he expected someone behind the door to give him an answer, right? He's asking her to let him in. The sky had lightened slightly, and there were two or three streaks of yellow floating above the horizon. Then, as he stood there, a tree of light burst over the skyline. Parker fell back against the door as if he had been penned there by a lance. "Who's there?" the voice from inside said, and there was a quality about it now that seemed final. The knob rattled and the voice said peremptorily, "Who's there?" Parker bent down and put his mouth near the stuffed keyhole. "Obadiah," he whispered, and all at once he felt the light pouring through him, turning his spiderweb soul into a perfect arabesque of colors, a garden of trees and birds and beasts. "Obadiah Elihu," he whispered. That's his real name, which he never tells anyone. And Obadiah is also a prophet from the Old Testament. The door opened and he stumbled in. Sarah Ruth loomed there, hands on her hips. She began at once. that was no hefty blonde woman you was working for, and you have to pay her every penny on her tractor you busted up. She don't keep insurance on it. She came here, and she had us a long talk, and I, trembling, Parker set about lighting the kerosene lamp. What's the matter with you, wasting that kerosene this near daylight, she demanded. I ain't got a look at you. A yellow glow enveloped them. Parker put the match down and began to unbutton his shirt. And you ain't gonna have none of me this near morning, she said. Shut your mouth, he said quietly. Look at this, and then I don't want to hear no more out of you. He removed the shirt and turned his back to her. Another picture, Sarah Ruth growled. I might have known you was off after putting some more trash on yourself. Parker's knees went hollow under him. He wheeled around and cried, look at it. Don't just say that. Look at it. I done looked, she said. Don't you know who this is? He cried in anguish. No. Who is it? Sarah Ruth said. It ain't nobody I know. It's him, Parker said. Him who? God, Parker cried. God? God don't look like that. What do you know how he looks? Parker moaned. You ain't seen him. He don't look, Sarah Ruth said. He's a spirit. No man shall see his face. Oh, listen, Parker groaned. This is a picture of him. Idolatry, Sarah Ruth screamed. Idolatry, inflaming yourself with idols under every green tree. I can put up with lies and vanity, but I don't want no idolater in this house. And she grabbed the broom and began to thrash him across the shoulders with it. Parker was too stunned to resist. He sat there and let her beat him until she had nearly knocked him senseless and large welts had formed on the face of the tattooed Christ. Then he staggered up and made for the door. She stamped the broom two or three times on the floor and went to the window and shook it out to get the taint of him off of it. Still gripping it, she looked towards the pecan tree and her eyes hardened still more. There he was, who called himself Obadiah Elihu, leaning against the tree, crying like a baby. That's it. That's the end of the story. It's astonishing because it ends in the central irony that the good Christian woman is unable to recognize the face of Christ, and she becomes one who participates, right, in his torture. And Parker has become God's unwitting prophet, precisely because of his openness to beauty and love and wonder. And like Christ, right, he is beaten and cast away by the supposedly religious types. This is an astonishing story, I think, about the power of art. And it's interesting to me that she chooses a low art, right? We're talking about tattoos. And I hate tattoos, for the record. I do not like them. But, you know, the contrast here is very obvious. From a kind of religiosity that simultaneously, astonishingly misses the incarnation entirely, right? Doesn't recognize that God does have a face, right? And doesn't see the icon truly in a way that Parker, totally untutored, sees it. And it's just really an astonishing reversal in the end. Now, we don't know what becomes of their marriage, which was never very good to begin with. But we do know that Parker is on a certain path, and the allusions to Parker being a literal prophet are all over this text. So I don't have time to sort of like put together all the threads, and I really, really, really hope you will read this story. But I think this is one of her stories, really, about the power of art and the power of images and the effects that they do have on us, and ways in which it might make some of us unwitting prophets. So, yeah, that's it for me. Maybe we can have some questions now. I went over. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.